Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Archbishop of Southwark in the British capital shares his hopes and expectations ahead of the papal visit to the United Kingdom in September. And to mark that historic event, four masterpieces of high Renaissance art designed by Raphael himself travel to London for a free exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Counting down to September the 16th and the start of Pope Benedict's four-day journey to the United Kingdom. This first ever state visit by a pontiff will begin with a meeting with Queen Elizabeth II at Holyrood House, her official Scottish residence in Edinburgh, and end with a beatification of the great English theologian and author of the 19th century, Cardinal John Henry Newman. An official visit to the Archbishop of Canterbury's headquarters at Lambeth Palace and a public address to politicians, lawmakers and opinion shapers in Westminster Hall at the Houses of Parliament will be other highlights on the papal agenda.
I'm very much looking forward to that in particular because the Great Hall at Westminster was where Thomas More was condemned to death.
A Londoner by birth and upbringing, Archbishop Peter Smith headed the Diocese of East Anglia before being appointed Archbishop of Cardiff in 2001. In April this year, he was named as the new Archbishop of Southwark, one of the largest diocese in the UK, comprising South London and most of the neighbouring county of Kent. On the feast of Saints Peter and Paul, he was one of the 38 new metropolitan archbishops to receive from Pope Benedict the pallium, that band of white wool worn as a sign of unity with the Holy See and the successor of Saint Peter.
This is my second pallium because I received one from Pope John Paul II back in 2002 when I was appointed Archbishop of Cardiff.
As he prepared to return home to his new London diocese, I talked with Archbishop Smith about the significance of this event and about his hopes and expectations for the upcoming papal visit in September.
The pallium basically symbolises the unity of the metropolitan archbishop with the Holy See. And I think that's it's a good thing to acknowledge, as it were, from time to time. I mean, hopefully we are very loyal to the Holy See, but it's a very public ceremony. And Pope Benedict was in very good form. And when I went to receive the pallium from him, he asked me where I was from. My Italian isn't brilliant, but I got that much. So I said to him, with a smile, I said, "I am the Englishman whom you have returned from Wales to his home diocese in Southwark." And he laughed. Because when we were out for the ad limina visit, you know, when we had the general audience with the Pope, he always presents a little present to everyone. And when I went up to receive mine, he looked at me and smiled. He said, "Ah," he said, "the Englishman in Wales." So he was obviously very well briefed. But it was lovely. I think there were 38 of us receiving the pallium from all around the world. And again, I thought it was a great sign and symbol of the universality of the Church. Much reflected, I might say, in my new Archdiocese of Southwark, because we have 40 different ethnic chaplaincies there. There's been a lot of immigration in London. Well, of course, I haven't worked in London as a priest for many a year, because I was in the seminary for 17 years teaching and then rector. Then I went as Bishop of East Anglia for 6.5 years. Having been nicely settled there, got sent down to Cardiff, where I had a very happy 8.5 years. And I thought, gracious, this is the third move I've had as a bishop.
So you're back in London, in the Diocese of Southwark. Tell us a little bit about it. You've talked a little bit about the wide variety of ethnic communities there. When people think of the Catholic Church in London, they maybe think more of Westminster. Tell us a bit about the specific nature of your diocese.
Yes, it's often been a question, why isn't there one diocese for the whole of London? But that usually comes from people who don't know London. I mean, I'm a South Londoner by birth and upbringing. And there's quite a different culture between London south of the River Thames and that in the north. And my diocese is the whole of South London and the county of Kent, so it's big. Well, somebody said it's the second biggest diocese in England and Wales, but I can't say with accuracy whether that's correct. So it's a mixture. London, very busy, a lot of people there. Kent, largely rural. So I think it's an advantage having that, because I think priests who are working certainly in the inner city areas, which can be quite taxing, do have a chance to be moved out to a quieter part of the diocese in Kent.
How would you describe perhaps the morale of the priests in your area and in the country as a whole at the moment?
Well, as far as Southwark goes, because I was only installed on the 10th of June, so I'm still finding my way around and, visiting places I knew years ago. But generally, because I've been out and about quite a bit for confirmations, parish celebrations like centenaries, I'm finding the priests in very good form. Good, confident, well aware of the difficulties the church is facing. But I also find the same amongst the people. The scandal of sex abuse has hit all of us hard. And I said in my Chrism Mass homily that we should always remember what St. Paul said in his letter to the Romans, that if one part of the body is hurt, the whole suffers. And it has been very humiliating. But I think in England and Wales, thank God, I mean, we started 10 years and more ago under Cardinal Cormac to put some very robust procedures in place to protect children and vulnerable adults. And that's been, I think, very successful. And so we hope we've got a good grip of that. It's very clear what we need to do if there's an allegation, and they're all referred immediately to the statutory authorities, social services, police. So I think, we had to learn a lot very rapidly. But I would say we have some of the most robust procedures for child protection of any institution in England and Wales.
Why do you think the church in England and Wales began dealing with this, as you say, so much earlier, a decade earlier than the other European countries, which are just now really beginning to deal with the fallout from it?
Well, it came to a head with one particular case where there was criticism of Cardinal Cormac. And again, it was a historic case. The abuse didn't occur actually in the diocese. It was a man went abroad. And I think, to give great credit to Cardinal Cormac, he seized the moment and said we were beginning to develop procedures for this as we began to understand better, the implications of abuse of children. And he appointed the Nolan Review, as we call it, Lord Nolan. A very good Catholic man, dead now, God rest him. But we had a year of I was the Episcopal representative on that. We had a lot of experts, most, in fact, not Catholics. Because, again, as bishops, we didn't understand how you dealt with these things. We would have, and did, deal with it pastorally, through the Sacrament of Reconciliation, getting priests to go away and go on retreat and so on. Because it all began to be quite a shock to us, because any abuse of anybody, but particularly of children by priests, is totally contrary to what we were ordained for. It's totally and utterly against the gospel. And I think many of us had great difficulty really believing that a priest could do such things. So it was a steep learning curve, and we soon found out, given the nature of those who are paedophiles, that it was a real problem and we had to tackle it, and he did. So we got a lot of very helpful recommendations from Lord Nolan, and then more recently, because we said at the end of the Nolan Review, when we made the recommendations to the Bishops' Conference, here were the recommendations, these should be put in place by agreement with all the bishops in England and Wales, and that the whole thing should then be reviewed in about 5 years to see had we got the right procedures, were there gaps, was it working well, and so on. So, again, Baroness Cumberledge, Julia Cumberledge, was appointed to chair a commission. And that was pretty rigorous as well. It was very open. We all had a chance to say what we thought. And that was a very positive one. The area that hadn't really been developed was the protection of vulnerable adults, but that is now in process. It's a rather more difficult area to deal with, because it's trying to find a definition of a vulnerable adult. I mean, in some ways we're all vulnerable, but you say it needs a lot of common sense, experience of people, but we've got a lot of experts, sensible experts, who help us with that. And every diocese now has a child protection commission, and it seems to be working extremely well.
This is within the church. You're confident that, as you say, you really have put this behind you. And yet somehow the public image of the church, particularly in the secular press, has difficulty moving on from that, doesn't it?
Yes. I think particularly the reports in Ireland shook everyone, and the Irish church, or church in Ireland, is suffering a great deal of that. Some of the media just will not let the matter go. They're perfectly entitled. It's their role to reveal scandals and so on. But I think our experience in England and Wales is it hasn't touched us quite so much. The press generally, I think, have acknowledged that we've done the best we can and have got very good procedures in place. But the trouble with media these days, and I'm making a very generalised remark, they love bad news. It sells newspapers, it makes people look at programmes. And I think there hasn't been the opportunity, really, for the church and others in society, because what is often forgotten, and the media don't bring this to light, is that child abuse is rife. But the heart of it is the vast majority of it occurs in family settings. You know, married men, or partners, as they're called these days. The number of priests involved is quite tiny. It's too much. There shouldn't be any. And I think there's almost an avoidance by some of the secular media to face the fact that it is something which the whole of society has got to tackle.
Looking ahead, you've got this papal visit coming up in just a few weeks' time. How is the church preparing for this historic event?
Well, there's been, obviously, it's quite a difficult thing to arrange because, first of all, it's a state visit, the first ever state visit of a pope to the United Kingdom. So the government is involved and they obviously want to get it absolutely right. The Vatican clearly is involved and the Bishops' Conference. So it's a three-way business trying to get agreement on where he should go, you know, what he might be speaking about and so on. There's a huge amount of work involved. I mean, I've been astonished at all the things that have to be done. There's security, you know, there's got to be time, obviously, for the Holy Father to have a rest because, with great respect, he's not a spring chicken anymore. And that's right and fitting. And, of course, his visit is quite short. When I was still in Cardiff in Wales, the Welsh were quite upset that he wasn't coming to Wales. And I said, well, you know, because they go back to when John Paul II came over back in the 80s. And I said he was a much, much younger man. It wasn't a state visit, so it was much easier to organise from the church's point of view. So I said, one, it's more complicated. But the First Minister, the new First Minister in Wales, Carwyn Jones, had been very good. He said, well, couldn't he pop over for 2 hours? I said, you can't do that sort of thing on a papal visit, you know. But there will be a special element in the Mass at Westminster Cathedral for Wales. So we'll make sure there's a good crowd from Wales coming up for that. But I think it's moving along now to being finalised, and we're very much looking forward to him coming because he's not very long now.
What kind of preparations are going on, for example, at parish diocesan level to prepare people for this visit?
Well, the Bishops' Conference have issued a booklet just to, you know, to give the general background for anybody who's not familiar with the church, for a start, saying, well, you know, what is a state visit for a pope? What is the church about? What do Catholics expect from the visit? On the Bishops' Conference website, there are daily bulletins there, prayers to be offered. And I think the thing at the moment is that people are getting quite excited because they want to be able to apply for tickets to the various venues. And, of course, they will be inevitably, again, because it's a state visit, you know, we can't just invite all the people we'd like to because there'll be visitors, you know, from the point of view of the government's perspective. So there's a lot of prayer going on. I think people are really looking forward to him coming. It'll be a great boost. We had, as you know, last year the visit of the relics of St. Tres, and that was supremely fruitful. great, great crowds coming to reverence the relics. And I think it gave great confidence back to the Catholic community that we can do this and what it means, you know, what sanctity means. Because that's a message that the world, our particular world over there, needs to hear.
Those who are expressing a lot of concern ahead of this visit, those already planning protests and so on, how much of a worry is this to you at the moment?
Perhaps I'm over-sanguine about it, but I don't think it's too much of a worry. I mean, the whole tradition of the United Kingdom for centuries has been one of freedom of speech, and people are entitled to express their view or their disagreement. And there may well be a few protests, but I think that will be overwhelmed, by, so to speak, by the, you know, the gratitude of Catholic people who want the Holy Father to come and will be delighted, and they will show their loyalty to the Holy See and the Church through that. And I think, you know, the security will be first class, as one would expect. So, yes, it's a concern, but I think it's going to be a very good visit.
And the secular media, which, as you say, is so keen on bad news rather than putting across good news stories.
From what I've heard, the secular media are absolutely agog with this. They all want, as they say in the jargon, a piece of the action. And I think there'll be quite a lot on the media, both radio and television. So from their point of view, no, because this will be quite a spectacular event. It's never happened before in the United Kingdom. So there's curiosity, there's looking for the opportunities for, you know, particularly on television, for the big ceremonies and so on, when perhaps he speaks in Westminster Hall, you know, which will be more to society at large, to the politicians, government and so on. I'm very much looking forward to that in particular because the Great Hall at Westminster was where Thomas More was condemned to death. And in Southwark, I was delighted, I'd forgotten, the Bishop's Chapel in Southwark, we have a stained glass window just behind the altar with John Fisher on one side and Thomas More on the other. And they've always been my two favourite saints.
So it's going to be an important moment, as you say, when Pope Benedict comes to make this public address. You've been for many years, haven't you, the public affairs spokesman, if you like, of the Bishops' Conference. He's going to make probably some quite interesting comments about the role and the place of church, the Catholic Church and of faith within society. What are you hoping for from this meeting in particular?
Well, I think what I'm hoping for, because he's a scholar, the Holy Father has a great capacity for explaining the role of the Church, and I think, and I would fully expect, he will make it quite clear there is a proper role for the secular state, but there's also a proper role for religion. It's when the state and the Church work together, which, of course, in England and Wales we've done for years in the area of education of children. Since 1944... there was the 1944 Education Act. The whole thrust of that is that for Catholic schools, this is a partnership between church and state. And that's held over the years. Of course, there's been a lot of criticism of faith schools, much of it stemming from total ignorance, and sometimes from an aggressively secular approach. So I'm sure, particularly at Westminster Hall, he will, you know, set out as clearly as can be done these days that there is a proper role for both. The Church does not want to take over the state. The Church is not imposing her doctrine or beliefs on others. We are proposing what we believe is good for society because the Church basically wants humanity to flourish. And the Gospels give us the way. I am the way, the truth, and the life. But, of course, as in our Lord's day, some will listen, others will reject that Gospel message with some vehemence and anger. A lot will be indifferent, because we live, as again in our Lord's day, I think, you know, when he went to Jerusalem, people are so busy about their own affairs, they don't seem to get the time to listen and reflect on what does it mean to be human? What's the purpose of human life? And what we've recently discovered in Europe and throughout the world is it is not about trying to amass vast quantities of money, the consumerist approach, because that has fallen flat on its face. And I think now it's a marvellous opportunity to help people to see there is more to life than money and material goods. The transcendent nature of human beings is absolutely vital, and that's what we've lost in a very secular society. To some extent it's there, but it's inarticulate, there's a yearning for something more, and I think we have the message to give to people and say, well, this is the way to live a happy, fulfilled life, to accept the sufferings that we all have in our lives, but we can be filled with the peace and the joy of Christ if we follow in his footsteps. Because he didn't say, come follow me and I'll put you on a nice bed of roses and everything will be absolutely wonderful. He was very clear, if you want to follow me, you must take up your cross every day. But he gives us the grace through the gift of the Spirit to do that. And so whatever's going on the surface of our lives, whether it's illness or difficulties, losing a job and so on, we have that strength of the Holy Spirit to carry us through, knowing that all our lives are in God's hands. And his providence will bring us through to the fullness of life in due time.
My thanks there to Archbishop Peter Smith of Southwark in the United Kingdom. To celebrate Pope Benedict's arrival in Britain in September, the Vatican Museums have sent over on loan to London 4 of the 10 giant tapestries designed by the great Renaissance artist Raphael to hang in the Sistine Chapel on special liturgical feast days. Depicting events from the lives of Saints Peter and Paul, these masterpieces of high Renaissance art will be on display for free in the Victoria and Albert Museum, as my colleague Emma McCarthy reports.
Commissioned in 1515 by Pope Leo X, they were to cover the lower walls of the Sistine Chapel, below the frescoes depicting the life of Moses and the life of Christ, on occasions of great solemnity. Raphael set about designing cartoons or preliminary coloured drawings for all 10 tapestries, which were then sent to the workshop of Peter van Aelst in Brussels, one of the most renowned weavers of tapestries. By 1519, 7 of the 10 tapestries were complete, and to the delight of Pope Leo X, were put on display in the Sistine Chapel on St. Stephen's Day of the same year, causing many among the congregation to exclaim, "They could not have been made by human hand." But their beauty came at a cost. One single tapestry cost 5 times more than Michelangelo's entire ceiling. Indeed, so rare and priceless that 2 emperors sought them out as spoils of war, Charles V in 1527 during the sack of Rome, and Napoleon in 1798. Once, they were even used as a guarantee against a loan. So beautiful that replicas of Raphael's tapestries were commissioned by several European monarchs. For while the completed tapestries had been returned to the Vatican, Raphael's cartoons had remained with the weaver van Aelst in Brussels. So it was that in 1533 King Francis I ordered his own series to adorn his palace walls. Not to be outdone, less than 10 years later, King Henry VIII of England, shortly after his schism from Rome, commissioned copies made from Raphael's cartoons in Brussels. Then, in 1632, Charles I, Prince of Wales, had the cartoons brought from Brussels to England to have his own set woven in the Mortlake Tapestry Workshops. And they have remained in England ever since. The Vatican owns the tapestries. The cartoons belong to Queen Elizabeth II. Now, for the first time in 500 years, they will be reunited in a once-in-a-lifetime exhibition in London's historic Victoria and Albert Museum. To coincide with Pope Benedict XVI's visit to England and Wales, four of the 10 tapestries will be hung alongside their original cartoons. It's a joint effort by the Vatican Museums and the V&A to bring a little bit of the Vatican to England. And before, the 500-year-old tapestries were gently packaged up, ready to be shipped off on their journey, they were hung once more exactly where they were meant to be, in the Sistine Chapel. Well, I couldn't miss this opportunity, though one balmy July evening, I went along with a small group of art lovers through the great bronze doors of the Vatican and up the giant staircase to the tiny Sistine Chapel. And as I stood before the tapestry of St. Paul in prison, to my delight, Professor Arnold Nesselrath of the Vatican Museums was there to guide us through the cycle. One of the curators and organizers of the exhibition, together with V&A director Mark Jones, he pointed out that not even the divine Raphael got to see his cartoons and tapestries side by side.
It's the Holy Father's gift to the United Kingdom when he's bringing that exhibition to London. It will be the first time in 500 years that the cartoons, i.e. seven paintings that have the same size as these tapestries, will hang next to the tapestries for which they're made, next to the end product. But tonight the tapestries have come back to the place which they were made for, and to be in a kind of painted symphony between the 15th century frescoes painted by the painters of Pope Leo X's father and Raphael's teachers and Michelangelo's ceiling. And this just demonstrates the cultural power that was in Rome at the beginning of the 16th century, created by these great popes.
It also underlines another aspect that's very important and integral to Pope Benedict's visit, and indeed the life of the Church, not only the Catholic Church, but the life of the British people, and that is their deep love and appreciation of culture.
But these tapestries are a kind of lingua franca, a common language that's accepted, that's actually copied by the English King, Henry VIII, immediately after the Anglican Schism. So Raphael's art can unite what has been divided by words.
Very interesting point is that this exhibition, which opens in September, when Pope Benedict will be in Great Britain, is free.
It's a real gift. They are the congiaria, like the Roman emperors, to the British people. It's a collaboration between Vatican institutions. Vatican Library wanted to contribute to this. The Master of Ceremonies is contributing to this. So it's actually the Vatican that's accompanying the Pope to the United Kingdom with a major cultural event. I must say, I mean, for me, it's a great experience. I've never organized anything that was so unanimously accepted by everybody who heard about it. And it is the Pope who makes this possible.
Thanks there to my colleague Emma McCarthy. Those tapestries and the cartoons will be on display for free in the Victoria and Albert Museum from September the 8th to October the 17th. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.